Chapter 20. In which the hero's aunt Diamond makes acquaintance with the hero's uncle, the failure of the Great Diddless X Association speedily became the theme of all the newspapers, and every person concerned in it was soon held up to public abhorrence as a rascal and a swindler. It was said that Bro had gone off with a million of money. Even it was hinted that Poorah had sent £100,000 to America, and only waited to pass through the court in order to be a rich man for the rest of my days. This opinion had some supporters in the prison, where, strange to say, it procured me consideration of which, as may be supposed, I was little inclined to avail myself. Mr. Aminadab, however, in his frequent visits to the fleet, persisted in saying that I was a poor-spirited creature, a mere tool in Bro's hands, and had not saved a shilling. Opinions, however, differed, and I believe it was considered by the turnkeys that I was a fellow of exquisite dissimulation, who had put on the appearance of poverty in order more effectually to mislead the public. Messrs. Abednego and Son were similarly held up to public odium. And, in fact, what were the exact dealings of these gentlemen with Mr. Bro I have never been able to learn. It was proved by the books that large sums of money had been paid to Mr. Abednego by the company, but he produced documents signed by Mr. Bro, which made the latter and the West Diddless X Association his debtors to a still further amount. On the day I went to the bankruptcy court to be examined, Mr. Abednego and the two gentlemen from Houndsditch were present to swear to their debts, and made a sad noise, and uttered a vast number of oaths in attestation of their claim. But Messrs. Jackson and Paxton produced against them that very Irish porter who was said to have been the cause of the fire, and, I am told, hinted that they had matter for hanging the Jewish gents if they persisted in their demand. On this they disappeared altogether, and no more was ever heard of their losses. I am inclined to believe that our director had had money from Abednego, had given him shares as bonus and security, had been suddenly obliged to redeem these shares with ready money, and so had precipitated the ruin of himself and the concern. It is needless to say herein what a multiplicity of companies Bro was engaged. That in which poor Mr. Tidd invested his money did not pay 2d. in the pound, and that was the largest dividend paid by any of them. As for ours, there was a pretty scene as I was brought from the fleet to the bankruptcy court, to give my testimony as late head clerk and accountant of the West Diddless X Association. My poor wife, then very near her time, insisted upon accompanying me to Bassingle Street. And so did my friend Gus Hoskins, that true and honest fellow. If you had seen the crowd that was assembled, and the hubbub that was made as I was brought up. Mr. Titmarsh, says the commissioner as I came to the table, with a peculiar sarcastic accent on the tit, Mr. Titmarsh, you were the confidant of Mr. Bro, the principal clerk of Mr. Bro, and a considerable shareholder in the company? Only a nominal one, sir, said I. Of course, only nominal, continued the commissioner, turning to his colleague with a sneer, and a great comfort it must be to you, sir, to think that you had a share in all the plunder profits of the speculation, and now can free yourself from the losses by saying you are only a nominal shareholder. The infernal villain, shouted out a voice from the crowd. It was that of the furious half-pay captain and late shareholder, Captain Spar. Silence in the court there, the commissioner continued. And all this, while Mary was anxiously looking in his face, and then in mine, as pale as death, while Gus, on the contrary, was as red as vermilion. Mr. Titmarsh, I have had the good fortune to see a list of your debts from the insolvent court, and find that you are indebted to Mr. Stilts, the great tailor, in a handsome sum, to Mr. Polonius, the celebrated jeweler, likewise, to fashionable milliners and dressmakers, moreover, and all this upon a salary of 200 L per annum. For so young a gentleman it must be confessed you have employed your time well. has this anything to do with the question, sir? Says one. Am I here to give an account of my private debts, or to speak as to what I know regarding the affairs of the company? As for my share in it, I have a mother, sir, and many sisters, the DD scoundrel! Shouts the captain. Silence that there, fellow! Shouts Gus, as bold as brass, at which the court burst out laughing, and this gave me courage to proceed. My mother, sir, 4 years since, having a legacy of 400L, left to her, advised with her solicitor, Mr. Smithers, how she should dispose of this sum, and as the independent West Didlisex was just then established, the money was placed in an annuity in that office, where I procured a clerkship. You may suppose me a very hardened criminal, because I have ordered clothes of Mr. Von Stilts, but you will hardly fancy that I, a lad of 19, knew anything of the concerns of the company into whose service I entered as 20th clerk, my own mother's money paying, as it were, for my place. Well, sir, the interest offered by the company was so tempting that a rich relative of mine was induced to purchase a number of shares. Who induced your relative, if I may make so bold as to inquire? I can't help owning, sir, says I, blushing, that I wrote a letter myself. But consider, my relative was 60 years old, and I was 21. My relative took several months to consider, and at the advice of her lawyers, before she acceded to my request. And I made it at the instigation of Mr. Bro, who dictated the letter which I wrote, and who I really thought then was as rich as Mr. Rothschild himself. Your friend placed her money in your name, and you, if I mistake not, Mr. Titmarsh, were suddenly placed over the heads of 12 of your fellow clerks as a reward for your service in obtaining it? It is very true, sir, and, as I confessed it, poor Mary began to wipe her eyes, and Gus's ears, I could not see his face, looked like two red-hot muffins, 'tis quite true, sir. And, as matters have turned out, I am heartily sorry for what I did. But at the time I thought I could serve my aunt as well as myself, and you must remember, then, how high our shares were. Well, sir, having procured this sum of money, you were straightway taken into Mr. Bro's confidence. You were received into his house, and from third clerk speedily became head clerk, in which post you were found at the disappearance of your worthy patron. Sir, you have no right to question me, to be sure, but here are 100 of our shareholders, and I'm not unwilling to make a clean breast of it, said I, pressing Mary's hand. Certainly was the head clerk. And why? Because the other gents left the office. I certainly was received into Mr. Bro's house. And why? Because, sir, my aunt had more money to lay out. I see it all clearly now, though I could not understand it then. And the proof that Mr. Bro wanted my aunt's money, and not me, is that, when she came to town, our director carried her by force out of my house to Fulham, and never so much as thought of asking me, or my wife thither. Eh, sir, and he would have had her remaining money, had not her lawyer from the country prevented her disposing of it. Before the concern finally broke, and as soon as she heard there was doubt concerning it, she took back her shares, scrip shares they were, sir, as you know, and has disposed of them as she thought fit. Here, sir, and gents, says I, you have the whole of the history as far as regards me. In order to get her only son a means of livelihood, my mother placed her little money with the company it has lost. My aunt invested larger sums with it, which were to have been mine one day, and they are lost too. And here am I, at the end of 4 years, a disgraced and ruined man. Is there anyone present, however much he has suffered by the failure of the company, that has had worse fortune through it than I? Mr. Titmarsh, says Mr. Commissioner, in a much more friendly way, and at the same time casting a glance at a newspaper reporter that was sitting hard by, your story is not likely to get into the newspapers. For, as you say, it is a private affair, which you had no need to speak of, unless you thought proper, and may be considered as a confidential conversation between us and the other gentlemen here. But if it could be made public, it might do some good, and warn people, if they will be warned, against the folly of such enterprises as that in which you have been engaged. It is quite clear from your story that you have been deceived as grossly as any one of the persons present. But look you, sir, if you had not been so eager after gain, I think you would not have allowed yourself to be deceived, and would have kept your relative's money, and inherited it, according to your story, one day or other. Directly people expect to make a large interest, their judgment seems to desert them. And because they wish for profit, they think they are sure of it, and disregard all warnings and all prudence. Besides the hundreds of honest families who have been ruined by merely placing confidence in this association of yours, and who deserve the heartiest pity, there are hundreds more who have embarked in it, like yourself, not for investment, but for speculation. And these, upon my word, deserve the fate they have met with. As long as dividends are paid, no questions are asked, and Mr. Bro might have taken the money for his shareholders on the high road, and they would have pocketed it, and not been too curious. But what's the use of talking? Says Mr. Commissioner, in a passion. Here's one rogue detected, and 1,000 dupes made, and if another swindler starts tomorrow, there will be 1,000 more of his victims round this table a year hence. And so, I suppose, to the end. And now let's go to business, gentlemen, and excuse this sermon. After giving an account of all I knew, which was very little, other gents who were employed in the concern were examined, and I went back to prison, with my poor little wife on my arm. We had to pass through the crowd in the rooms, and my heart bled as I saw, amongst a score of others, poor Gates, Bro's porter, who had advanced every shilling to his master, and was now, with 10 children, houseless and penniless in his old age. Captain Spar was in this neighborhood, but by no means so friendly disposed. For while Gates touched his hat, as if I had been a lord, the little captain came forward threatening with his bamboo cane and swearing with great oaths that I was an accomplice of Bro. Curse you for a smooth-faced scoundrel, says he. Hat business have you to ruin an English gentleman, as you have me? And again he advanced with his stick. But this time, officer as he was, Gus took him by the collar, and shoved him back, and said, look at the lady, you brute, and hold your tongue. And when he looked at my wife's situation, Captain Spar became redder for shame than he had before been for anger. I'm sorry she's married to such a good-for-nothing, muttered he, and fell back. And my poor wife and I walked out of the court, and back to our dismal room in the prison. It was a hard place for a gentle creature like her to be confined in, and I longed to have some of my relatives with her, when her time should come. But her grandmother could not leave the old lieutenant, and my mother had written to say that, as Mrs. Haggerty was with us, she was quite as well at home with her children. What a blessing it is for you, under your misfortunes, continued the good soul, to have the generous purse of your aunt for succor. Generous purse of my aunt, indeed. Where could Mrs. Haggerty be? It was evident that as he had not written to any of her friends in the country, nor gone thither, as she threatened. But as my mother had already lost so much money through my unfortunate luck, and as he had enough to do with her little pittance to keep my sisters at home, and as, on hearing of my condition, she would infallibly have sold her last gown to bring me aid, Mary and I agreed that we would not let her know what our real condition was bad enough. Heaven knows, and sad and cheerless. Old Lieutenant Smith had likewise nothing but his half-pay and his rheumatism, so we were, in fact, quite friendless. That period of my life, and that horrible prison, seemed to me like recollections of some fever. What an awful place! Not for the sadness, strangely enough, as I thought, but for the gaiety of it, for the long prison galleries were, I remember, full of life and a sort of grave bustle. All day and all night doors were clapping to and fro, and you heard loud voices, oaths, footsteps, and laughter. Next door to our room was one where a man sold gin, under the name of Tape. And here, from morning till night, the people kept up a horrible revelry, and sang sad songs, some of them. But my dear little girl was, thank God, unable to understand the most part of their ribaldry. She never used to go out till nightfall, and all day she sat working at a little store of caps and dresses for the expected stranger, and not, she says to this day, unhappy. But the confinement sickened her, who had been used to happy country air, and she grew daily paler and paler. The Fives Court was opposite our window, and here I used, very unwillingly at first, but afterwards, I do confess, with much eagerness, to take a couple of hours' daily sport. Ah! It was a strange place. There was an aristocracy there as elsewhere, amongst other gents, a son of my Lord Ducase, and many of the men in the prison were as eager to walk with him, and talked of his family as knowingly, as if they were Bond Street bucks. Poor Tid, especially, was one of these. Of all his fortune he had nothing left, but a dressing case and a flowered dressing gown, and to these possessions he added a fine pair of mustaches, with which the poor creature strutted about, and though cursing his ill fortune, was, I do believe, as happy whenever his friends brought him a guinea, as he had been during his brief career as a gentleman on town. I have seen sauntering dandies in watering places ogling the women, watching eagerly for steamboats and stagecoaches, as if their lives depended upon them, and strutting all day in jackets up and down the public walks. Well, there are such fellows in prison. Quite as dandified and foolish, only a little more shabby dandies with dirty beards and holes at their elbows. I did not go near what is called the poor side of the prison. I dared not, that was the fact. But our little stock of money was running low, and my heart sickened to think what might be my dear wife's fate, and on what sort of a couch our child might be born. But heaven spared me that pang, heaven, and my dear good friend, Gus Hoskins. The attorneys to whom Mr. Smithers recommended me, told me that I could get leave to live in the rules of the Fleet, could I procure sureties to the marshal of the prison for the amount of the detainer lodged against me, but though I looked Mr. Blatherwick hard in the face, he never offered to give the bail for me, and I knew no housekeeper in London who would procure it. There was, however, one whom I did not know, and that was old Mr. Hoskins, the Leathersiller of Skinner Street, a kind fat gentleman, who brought his fat wife to see Mrs. Titmarsh, and though the lady gave herself rather patronizing airs, her husband being free of the Skinner's company, and bidding fair to be alderman, nay, Lord Mayor of the first city in the world, she seemed heartily to sympathize with us, and her husband stirred and bustled about until the requisite leave was obtained, and I was allowed comparative liberty. As for lodgings, they were soon had. My old landlady, Mrs. Stokes, sent her Jemima to say that her first floor was at our service, and when we had taken possession of it, and I offered at the end of the week to pay her bill, the good soul, with tears in her eyes, told me that she did not want for money now, and that she knew I had enough to do with what I had. I did not refuse her kindness, for, indeed, I had but 5 guineas left, and ought not by rights to have thought of such expensive apartments as hers. But my wife's time was very near, and I could not bear to think that she should want for any comfort in her lying in. The admirable woman, with whom the Mrs. Hoskins came every day, to keep company and very nice, kind ladies they are, recovered her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.